The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dick Hayden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Sports Illustrated for Kids magazine. It will be volume 32, number 6 of SIK. We're going to go over a series of articles that we find in the magazine today. In fact, I think you might get a kick out of a number of them. At least I hope you do. Let's begin with a look at women's basketball. Multi-talented Juju Watkins is the future of basketball on the court and off of it. Turning the page, the article begins as follows. Vanessa Nygaard first saw Juju Watkins 4 years ago at an open house at the Windward School in Los Angeles. Juju was about to enter as a seventh grader, and Nygaard was the basketball coach for the girls' high school squad. Nygaard, a former star at Stanford who played 6 seasons in the WNBA, had heard about Juju. Her reputation preceded her, Nygaard says. With good reason, it turns out. Wearing jeans and a pair of Vans, Juju leaped up and grabbed the rim, then got a ball, dribbled it through her legs a few times, and drained a fadeaway three-pointer. That's impressive. Nygaard, who was standing with the boys' basketball coach, Colin Pfaff, was awestruck. He said, "I think that's the best player I've ever seen." And I said, "Maybe that's what an Olympian looks like." We were just amazed. She was just making these boys her age respect women's basketball. Juju wasn't allowed to play with the high school team until last year when she was a freshman. But when she finally took the court for Nygaard, it was worth the wait. Juju, who is ranked as the top player in the country in the class of 2023, was named the city's Girls Player of the Year by the Los Angeles Times. At 6 feet tall, she can handle the ball like a point guard, score buckets in traffic at the rim, and drain three-pointers. She can play anywhere on the floor. It's a new age skill set, says Nygaard. But that's not the only reason Judea Watkins, nicknamed Juju, is the 2020 Sports Kid of the Year. On the court, she represents the future of the women's game, but this year it became more clear than ever that an athlete's role is not limited to what they can do during a game. And that's one of the things that truly excites Juju when she talks about her future. The opportunity to influence and to motivate. I want to inspire people, no matter where they come from, to believe in yourself and always to push to be great, she says. In 2020, we saw several instances of athletes, especially women's basketball players, protesting for racial equality and justice. It's an issue that means a lot to Juju. She lives in Watts, an inner-city section of Los Angeles known for its minority population. Her great-grandfather was Ted Watkins, who founded the Watts Labor Community Action Committee, WLCAC, an organization that helps build housing and improve the quality of life for citizens. "He played a big part for me, even though I was too young to meet him," says Juju, whose grandfather, Tim, now runs the WLCAC. "But I feel his legacy passed on to me, so I feel it's like it's my responsibility, and it's my turn to give back to the community." When Juju started playing basketball around the time she was 6 years old, she often competed against boys on a court at the WCLAC. By the time she reached Windward in the seventh grade, she was unstoppable. Opponents would throw every defense imaginable at her, including a variation on the box and one. Normally in that scheme, four defenders play a zone defense and the other shadows the opposing team's best offensive threat. In Juju's case, the four-person box guarded her. It still couldn't stop her. Last season, when she finally got to play with the high school team, she didn't just have to cope with playing against older players. She had to learn to play alongside them as well. "Going into the season, I was a little timid," But I learned to speak up for myself because that was a big part of becoming part of the team. I feel like a lot of people just expected me to come into high school and become that mediocre player who was good in middle school but doesn't translate to high school. So I felt like it was up to me to prove them wrong, to prove that I am able to advance and evolve. She certainly did. Juju led the team in virtually every official stat, scoring, rebounding, assists, steals, and a few unofficial ones, blocked shots that made even opposing fans go wild. Among the people who noticed her was Kobe Bryant, who followed her on Instagram. "It was crazy," Juju says. "That was one of the best days of my life." One of her best games of the year came on the biggest stage during the state playoffs on the campus of Long Beach State University. A lot of times freshmen just cave, but she was like, "This is my moment," says Nygaard. "I have had a chance to work with USA Basketball, and great players don't get nervous. They get excited for a big game. I've only had one other player, Jordan Canada, who's actually been excited for the big game like that and not nervous. When she was the number 5 pick in the WNBA draft, in a tough defeat for rival Mater Dei High, Juju scored 28 points. Shortly after, schools in California were closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Over the summer, Juju decided not to play AAU ball to keep herself and her family safe from the coronavirus. She worked with her trainers and honed her shot with her dad, Robert, who doubles as her shooting coach. Juju says she's already a better shot than dad, who doesn't agree. "You're not going to get a conclusion there," laughs her mom, Sari. In addition to helping her with her game, her parents also helped Juju, who is an avid sneakerhead, design her own brand logo. "She's big on business," says Robert. "She's trying to change the women's game, but maybe changing the big shoe deal, a merchandise deal. She's trying to change the game so that girls behind her can capitalize on the work she puts in." Juju knows she's a long way off from shoe deals, but that's not stopping her from aiming high. "When her career is over," she says, "I want to be looked at as a Hall of Famer and somebody who changed the game and paved the way for equality in sport and equality for females in general." That's quite an amazing person. She's got a list of some things here. Juju Watkins' favorite things, in fact. Her favorite actor is Zendaya. Her favorite food, pasta. I like that. Favorite dessert, vanilla ice cream. I'm with you there, girl, all the way. Her favorite athlete, Liz Cambage, C-A-M-B-A-G-E. Her favorite other sport is tennis. Her favorite TV show is Avatar, The Last Airbender. Her favorite book, Finish First by Mally Nicole. And her favorite class in school. You ready for it, sports fans? It's English. English. How many people really like English as a class if they're an athlete? Well, probably a lot, but you don't run into it every day. How about if we take a look at Jock Talk? The title is Jock Talk Unlocked. The dictionary tells only half the story, the truth about sports' strangest terms. Battery, that's the first one, battery. In baseball, there is a batter, but add a Y and you have the hitter's sworn enemy, the battery, the duo of the pitcher and the catcher. The words share an origin, battere or something like that, B-A-T-T-U-E-R-E. Latin is not my big sport here, folks. And it's a verb, and it means hit. But it evolved in very different ways to become baseball terms. From the Latin, the word became the French B-A-T-R-E and the English batter, B-A-T-T-E-R. It's easy to see how this word, meaning to hit repeatedly, would become our English word for a guy who socks the baseball over the fence. The French word also took another form, however, batterie, which became the English battery, meaning a beating. The battery then became the metal instruments themselves used in hammering or beating objects. Then the metal instruments used in war for hammering an enemy force, cannons and guns. Thus, the baseball term arose as a military metaphor. The pitcher was the artillery of the defending team, hurling projectiles at the opposing hitter. Battery commonly refers these days to the little cylinders that make the TV remote work. There are different theories of how that meaning arose. One is that the discharge of electricity was compared to the discharge of bullets and cannonballs, a similar origin to the baseball team. With the prospect of automated balls and strikes calls on the horizon, can we suggest a new slang term for robot umpires? Batteries, as in the batteries blew a call, signaling ball, helping the batter beat up on the battery. I think that last one got a little funny. Well, our next jock talk term, key, K-E-Y. Basketball players are often described as shooting from the top of the key. Even before understanding the origin of the term, the phrase is confusing. Borrow a key from an adult. Where would you say the top is? Is it the tip of the part that goes into the lock? Is it the loop that connects to a keychain? Alas, this riddle is irrelevant. In hoops geography, the key actually alludes to the top of a keyhole. The paint on modern courts is 16 feet wide, which combines with the circle around the free throw line to create a silo shape. Older courts, however, featured a much skinnier paint, which formed an equally old-timey keyhole shape instead. How about waffle board? Thanks to the on-air vocabulary of hockey announcer Mike Doc Emmerich, the phrase waffle board has become a verb, meaning to deflect the puck with the goalie's stick hand in hockey. The phrase is slang for the rectangular pad that protects that hand. These days, blocker pads are slightly angled to conform to the curve of the wrist and often feature decorative geometric designs on the outside. In the early days of goalie equipment, however, the rectangular leather pads had a series of little holes that made them look like breakfast. So if you're used to a round, gridded Eggo waffle, this might still make no sense to you at all. Oh, try this one, can of corn. In baseball, an easy-to-catch fly ball is called a can of corn. But what makes a can of corn easy? One theory relates to an activity all kids understand, knocking something off the top shelf. Long before you were scaling cabinets to reach Oreos, employees used sticks to knock cans off the top shelves at general stores. As the item fell straight down, the grocer would catch it easily. Now, please do not blame this magazine when you knock a vase off the mantle with a hockey stick. Your mother's still going to be very, very upset. Nickelback. Quarterback. Football has a coin obsession. Like the batter and the battery, however, the nickelback and the quarterback came about differently. Quarterback is a 19th century term that refers to the signal caller's position in the traditional I formation. They are halfway between the halfback and the line of scrimmage. In other words, they're a quarter of the way back. The halfback is halfway between the line and the fullback. The nickelback, on the other hand, is the fifth secondary player introduced in a nickel defense, named for Chicago Bears assistant George Allen in the 1960s. The nickel here does allude to the coin, 5 cents for five defensive backs. Well, you know, there's some history that I sure did not know. I'll bet you didn't know it all either. But as they say, now you do. I rather like the title of this next article. I hope you do as well, because it's asking us to think about, well, what if? And that actually is the title of the article. What if? In this case, what if Wayne Gretzky had been born in the USSR, Russia? Russia's 1917 Bolshevik Revolution created one of history's great political powers, the Soviet Union. Indirectly, it created both of history's great hockey powers. Three decades later, the Soviets first laced up, transforming ice hockey with innovative tactics. In 1917, however, the conflict drove Anton Gretzky, the grandfather of the sport's greatest player, from, quote, White Russia, end quote, that is, modern-day Belarus, a Soviet state, to Canada. While Russian players quietly revolutionized hockey on one side of the globe, so did Wayne Gretzky, the son of a telephone repairman in Canada. Eventually, Canada and the USSR would meet on the ice, creating the most indelible moments in the history of the sport. Off the ice, they would become friends. Would Gretzky still be the GOAT, G-O-A-T, had his family remained in Belarus? He likely would have grown up in the Soviet sports system, funneled toward Moscow, like all promising young players. How would hockey be different if Canada's great one had been Russia's secret weapon? The Soviet system found hockey players early. Grade school age kids were tested for aptitude in the sport. Gretzky was never the biggest or fastest player, but it is unlikely that his physique would have prevented him from standing out. He was a prodigy. At the age of 6, the same age as many youngsters entered the Soviet hockey system, Gretzky was playing against 10-year-olds, practicing daily on a custom rink in his backyard in Canada. He scored 1,097 goals before the age of 14. Once fast-tracked for a spot on the USSR's national team, Gretzky would have fit right in. The Soviet game developed independently of the Canadian style. Anatoly Tarasov, the father of Russian hockey, envisioned a version of hockey more like soccer. Players would pass backward and side to side in an attempt to keep possession of the puck and confuse the opposing defenses. It worked. The USSR won 30 gold medals in Olympic and World Championship play. That's why 1980's U.S. victory at the Olympics, the miracle on ice, was, well, a miracle. The Russian game elevated passing. Gretzky is the greatest passer of all time. His NHL record of 1,963 career assists will likely never fall. Gretzky is a Soviet jersey. Gretzky in a Soviet jersey may look wrong, but on the ice, it would have fit him perfectly. Granted, there were major differences in how they passed. His style was so unusual for us, Russian center Igor Larionov wrote in the Hockey News about playing against Gretzky. Usually in the Russian system, the center stays back and never goes deeper than the hash marks. But Wayne was playing behind the net. We never had seen anyone do that, and it was big trouble for us. Still, it's possible to imagine a different but equally effective Gretzky. The Great One would call Larionov as similar to me as any player who has played the game. Number 99 would have likely taken his spot as the number one center on the USSR's starting five green unit. Ultimately, Soviet dominance makes this scenario a little boring. Gretzky and the USSR would both still be great. The story of the Belarusian Great One really gets interesting when considering the impact of a different historical event, the fall of the Iron Curtain. When Ewen, okay, that's Gretzky's first name, so when Ewen, quote, Wayne, close quote, that must be the way they pronounce it there, Gretzky arrived in Vancouver in 1989, the defector was famous among hockey diehards, but hardly a household name. Fans in Ontario accused their countrymen on Canada's west coast of treason for cheering for the player who had embarrassed them in the 1987 and 1991 Canada Cups. Canadians have a lot of national pride wrapped up in hockey. And it wasn't just that Gretzky beat them. It was how. The skinny center got flack for playing a typically European game, avoiding contact, and using finesse. No Canadian would ever play like that. To make matters worse, Gretzky took time to adjust to the NHL. He logged 95 points in 1989-1990, good enough to crack the top 25 in scoring, but barely good enough to elevate his Sharks over the lowly Kings in the Smith Division. Slowly, however, his point totals climbed, and with them the esteem of the opposing fans. In 1994, the Belarusian War, affectionately known as the Star, rather, I said that wrong. In 1994, the Belarusian Star, affectionately known as the Wizard, topped the league with 144 points and delivered the Sharks to their first title when they narrowly defeated Gretzky rival Mark Messier's Rangers in 7 games. That offseason, the Sharks shocked the hockey world when they dealt their aging star to the Detroit Red Wings for a bevy of draft picks. Gretzky was the missing piece in the Detroit coach Scotty Bowman's Russian Five, a starting unit meant to unlock the full power of the Soviet system in the NHL. Alongside young Russian phenom Sergei Fedorov and former teammates like Slava Fedosov, Gretzky flourished. After the lockout shortened 1994-95 season, Gretzky chased Penguins stars Mariel Lemieux and Yermo Yagar for the 1995-1996 scoring title. While Gretzky's 152 points topped Yager's 149 and fell short of Lemieux's 161, his wings won the Stanley Cup, and his performance sparked plenty of debates about how a prime-era Gretzky would have fared in the NHL. A vocal minority of fans argue, and still argue, that he could have been even better than Lemieux, perhaps the greatest NHLer of all time. I want to take a look at another article, folks. This one's going to come from a prior issue. It's number 5 out of volume 32. It is about Giovanni Reyna, the 17-year-old son of former U.S. men's national team captain, is thriving in the Bundesliga, where he's living up to the hype and proving that he belongs on soccer's biggest stage. Great soccer player. As the time was ticking down at the UEFA Champions League round of 16 game between Borussia Dortmund and Paris Saint-Germain, a giant shoving match broke out between the teams. Dortmund's Giovanni Reyna, a 17-year-old, found himself next to one of the biggest stars in the game, PSG's Kylian Mbappe. This was Reyna's chance, and there was no hesitation. He had been thinking about this for a while. His father, National Soccer Hall of Fame midfielder Claudio Reyna, collected jerseys during his days as U.S. men's national team captain and a star of 7 European clubs. "My dad has a few bags full of jerseys," Gio said. "He has a Thierry Henry. He has Steven Gerrard. Ever since I was young, I thought it was so cool, and I always thought that one day, who knows, if I have kids or just look back on it, I could say, oh yeah, I got Mbappe's jersey." When the French World Cup winner approached, the American took his chance. In some places, it might be considered bad form for a player facing elimination to inquire about a jersey swap. Those should be solemn moments. Maybe Reyna, the rookie, should have ignored Mbappe's and rushed in to prove his worth in the scrum. Or maybe he should have thought about the possibility of looking like a star-struck teen. A person with less confidence, with a slight fear that he was out of his element, would have seized up and wasted the opportunity. Reyna is not that person, no. So I just asked him, "Can I have your jersey?" And he said, "Yeah, of course. Just see me after the game and I'll give it to you." So after the game, obviously, we lost. I went up to him, tapped him quickly and asked for the jersey, and he gave it to me just like that. It was crazy. He kind of gave me a big hug. It was so cool. Mbappe's jersey will represent the fitting a fitting early memory of a career that holds almost limitless promise. Rainier belonged. In fact, he was welcomed, as if he was right where he was supposed to be. That moment with Mbappe was made for him, and he was made for that moment. His parents played soccer. His mother appeared 6 times for the U.S. women's team. His father, his friends are soccer players, including Sebastian Bellar, the Columbus Crew midfielder, whose father, Greg, is coach of the U.S. men's national team. If he didn't have such affable personality, you think Gio was designed to be a lab specifically to play this sport with equal parts of technique, physique, and vision. Rainier signed with Dortmund in July 2019 after spending time with the club's senior side during its U.S. tour. He moved to Germany and joined Dortmund's U19s. It echoed the path of fellow U.S. youngster Christian Pulsic, who joined the club early in 2015 and started with the U17s. Sebastian Kehl, who coaches for Dortmund, said after Rainier signed that, "We want to build Gio slowly, as we did with Christian, slowly and carefully." It took Pusilic 11 months to make his Bundesklub debut. He has since transferred to Chelsea. Rainier put himself on a different timetable. Slowly for him isn't slowly for us. He trained with the first team during the 2019-20 winter break and never looked back. How about that? On January 18, he made his first team debut as a second-half substitute against Augsburg at 17 years and 65 days old. He became the youngest American to play in Bundesliga. His career is moving fast, but on the field, as it does for the greats. The game has a way of slowing down for him. A little more than 2 weeks after his debut, he became a 66th-minute substitute in a game against Werder Bremen. 12 minutes later, the game slowed. A brilliant first touch allowed Reina to bypass one defender. 3 more touches left 2 more opponents floundering. Then, as a fourth closed down him down, Reina released a stunning 18-yard curling shot into the upper right corner of the net. I just didn't really think. I saw the top corner kind of open up, and I just tried to put it there, he says. It's going to be hard for me to score a better goal, but I think I'll score a better one. I have time. It went viral, both in the U.S. and in the back of the team bus. He wasn't sure how many times he had checked out the clip when he realized veteran Mario Götze was standing over his shoulder. That guy knows a thing or two about scoring amazing goals. His volley won the World Cup for Germany in 2014, and he had a little laugh at his young teammate's expense. But it was a good sign for Reina, because like Mbappe's jersey, the goal and his enjoyment of it reveal an instinct to stop and appreciate the journey. He's a different player than his father. Claudio controlled games. Gio changes him. He goes by defenders with power, and he's doing it at a really young age. That's what's enticing as a coach. If he continues to develop, it's going to be scary for what he can do, his coach says. Well, gang, we're coming to the end of another episode of Sports Illustrated Kids. I certainly hope that you have enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Dick Hayden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated for Kids is available as a podcast at our website, North Carolina Reading Service. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service and Sports Illustrated Kids.